It was Saturday, and all the field hands and work crews had left for the weekend. He thought first of going fishing, but this too was no fun alone. Many times on lonely nights and weekends, he wished he had never left the homestead, where at least he would have the companionship of Lester and Tim and Jesse. One of the reasons for leaving was to escape the loneliness, but instead he had trapped himself in a situation far worse than the one he left. There was nothing in the nearby villages of Clewiston and Belglade but a few stores and small cafes where he often took evening meals to escape the boredom of cooking for himself. He longed for one of his mother's meals or one prepared by Jesse. Good, wholesome food and not something always fried in stale grease that should have been dumped long ago. The villages were also void of people his age, for all of them, except a few engaged in commercial fishing or working as field hands, migrated as soon as they could to find jobs in Palm Beach or Miami. He went into the bedroom, put on fresh jeans and a denim jacket, and attempted to dust off his boots. Then he went outside and got into one of the Ford Model T trucks he had purchased for delivering vegetables. The motor sputtered to life, shaking the fenders as if they would fall off. Then he put it in gear and ambled off, the rutted sand road causing it to rattle even worse. There was a dirt road leading directly east from Belglade, crossing 47 miles of prairie into West Palm Beach. He pointed the Model T in that direction and floored the accelerator, sounding like an approaching hurricane as he roared across the land. Terrified rabbits jumped 6 feet high as they bounded out of his path, competing with frightened deer that almost trampled the smaller animals as they rushed past them. Birds flew, too, and buzzards circled overhead, watching all of it, sensing there would soon be some kind of disaster that provided food. When he reached West Palm Beach, he sped right through it, scattering chickens and cats and dogs, stirring up a cloud of dust until he hit the wooden bridge leading across the water to Palm Beach proper. The accelerator was still on the floor as he drove straight to the driveway of the Royal Poinciana Hotel, came to a screeching halt in front of the main entrance, and jumped out. A cloud of blue smoke drifted across the veranda, and steam made angry, hissing sounds as it boiled from beneath the truck's hood. The doorman came down the steps hurriedly, eyeing the McIvey Produce Company sign on the dusty truck's door. He commanded Saul, "Get that damn thing out of here! Are you crazy? All deliveries are made at the rear entrance. Move it, fellow!" Saul glared back defiantly, and then he said, "I'm not delivering anything. I'm a customer. And I want a room here for the weekend, and you best let the truck sit right here till I go in and inquire about it. You so much as touch it, I'll cram that fancy little hat you got on right up your ass." The doorman stared sullenly as Saul stalked off. Several guests who watched the brief encounter turned away, heading for the area where the bicycle wicker chairs were parked. Saul crossed the lobby briskly, going straight to the counter, popping his hand several times on a little bell. A man in a white linen suit came from behind a shelf of key boxes and said, "Something I can do for you?"
"I want a room," Saul said impatiently. "One with a view of the ocean, if you got it. Otherwise, I'll take anything."
The clerk looked first at the jeans and denim jacket, at the boots with mud caked to the soles. Then he examined a ledger briefly and said,
"If you don't have a confirmed reservation, we're all full, and I assume you don't."
"That's right, I don't," Saul replied, taking a thick roll of bills from his pocket. "You folks pulled that reservation shit on my papa when my mama wanted to stay here. I don't have a reservation, but I've got enough money here to choke a stallion. You gonna give me a room or not?"
"I've already told you," the man said indignantly. "We're full up."
"Okay," Saul said, putting the money back into his pocket. "My name is McIvey, Saul McIvey. I want you to remember that. One of these days I'll build my own hotel, and it'll be a heap sight better than this dump, so damn you and your stinking rooms."
As Saul turned away, the man said, "Cracker, hick." When he got back to the truck, he drove it off the driveway and right down the middle of a flower bed, scattering plants in all directions, hearing the doorman run after him screaming obscenities as he swerved back onto the driveway and sped away. The truck now decorated gaily with scarlet poinsettia bracts. It was an hour past noon when he got back into West Palm Beach, as he parked in front of a cafe, got out, and went inside. It was nothing fancy but clean, with good smells coming from the kitchen. tables were covered with checkered cloths, and several people, obviously workers from their dress, were finishing eating. A waitress came over and handed Saul a menu. She appeared to be about 20, with long blonde hair and blue eyes. Her figure filled the uniform to perfection, and she would be extremely pretty except for the dour look on her face. Saul said, "You sell beer?"
"Yeah, what kind you want, bottle or draft?"
"Hell, I don't know. What's the difference?" She gave him a queer look and replied, "One comes in a bottle, that's bottle beer. The other is drawn from a barrel and comes in a mug, that's draft.
You think you can make up your mind now?"
"Draft," Saul said sullenly, the anger still boiling. "And I'll have the blue plate special." He watched as she walked away, noticing the gentle sway of her hips, the graceful curve of her legs. When she came back with the beer, he said, "You know, you'd be as pretty as a speckled calf if you'd just smile." She did smile, and then she said,
"Thanks. Most folks never give me a compliment. They just gripe about how slow the service is, and I do the best I can. But you don't look like Mr. Sunshine yourself. You came busting in here like a thunderhead."
"I guess I did," Saul said, chuckling. "I had a bad experience over in Palm Beach, and it sort of got my dander up."
"It's not hard to do over there. I stay away from that place. All those old men in their knickers ever do is leer and try to get you in bed with them. I don't know what they could do if they did. Probably nothing."
Saul immediately liked her, her frankness reminding him of things his mother often said to Zek. He said, "What's your name?"
"Bonnie."
"Bonnie what?"
"Bonnie O'Neill. My daddy's Irish."
"I'm Saul McIvey. My daddy was a cracker."
"Cracker?" she giggled. "What's that?"
"Men who run after cows cracking whips. That's how come they're called crackers."
"Is that what you do? Run after cows?"
"I used to, but I'm in the vegetable business now."
"We got a garden, too, but Daddy won't put a hand to it. He makes me do all the work. Where's your place?"
"Over at Lake Okeechobee."
She glanced back toward the kitchen and said, "I better get your food before Mr. Lumpkin comes shouting at me. I'll be right back."
When she returned, Saul said, "What time you get off work here?"
2:00.
"You're the last customer for the noon serving, but I have to come back at 5 and work another 2 hours." "You want to go over to the beach for a while?"
"And do what?"
she asked suspiciously. "Sit. We could gawk at the men in their knickers, like they do us. After that, I'll have to go on back to Okeechobee. I don't like to be on the road at night. If my truck broke down, the skeeters would eat me alive."
"Sure, why not? It would beat going home and washing clothes. I'll meet you a block down the street. Mr. Lumpkin would have a stroke if he saw me leave here with a customer. He didn't allow that at all."
They sat on a small area of public beach, watching waves roll in from the ocean and sandpipers scurrying about, pecking frantically at the sand as the water rushed back. Saul said, "Those little birds sure are swift. They never get their feet wet. Reminds me of a wild bull when you trap him in a palmetto clump. You never know which way he's going to go."
"Mama used to like to come here and watch the birds. She's dead now, died 3 years ago.
"What does your papa do?" Saul asked.
"He's a groundskeeper at the hotel. Mama worked there too, in the kitchen, till she took sick. Since she died, Daddy don't do nothing but drink. I have to cook all the meals and do the washing and cleaning and tend the garden. When Daddy gets home from work, he's drunk before supper."
"If you have to do all that, how come you work in the cafe, too?"
"Daddy makes me. He wants the money for liquor. And he takes all of it. He won't even give me a dollar to buy toilet water. If I get a tip, I hide it in my shoe so he can't find it."
Saul became silent for a moment, thinking. And then he said, "How much you make at that cafe?"
$20 a month."
"Would you like to change jobs?"
"I sure would. But there's nowhere else for me to go. Those people won't hire me in their fancy shops. And I don't want to work at the hotel. I tried that once in the housekeeping department. And I just couldn't stand those old men leering at me. And I had to clean 20 rooms every day. You'd be surprised what's in some of those rooms. Some of them have mirrors over the beds."
"That's not what I mean," Saul said. "How'd you like to come and work for me?"
"Doing what?"
she asked, surprised, suspicious again. I need someone to do the cooking and look after the house. I'm tired of being alone and having to do all the housework myself. I'll pay you $100 a month. She turned to him and said,
$100 a month? I've never seen that much money. How much of a garden have you got if you can pay $100 a month for a cook?
130,000 acres. And a good bit more at other places.
Good Lord!
She exclaimed, not knowing whether to believe him or not. But he said it too matter-of-factly to be lying. Then she said,
If you're so tired of being alone, how come you haven't married? It would be a whole lot cheaper than hiring a cook at that price.
Papa told me once that getting married is like owning dogs. You get to liking them too much, and it pains you when they go away. I saw it happen to Grampy when my granny died, and then to Papa, too. It pained them both worse than I've ever seen. I'm just not sure yet I want to try it. Maybe someday.
For that much money, would I have to sleep with you, too?
She asked seriously. Not if you don't want to, Sol replied, even more amused by her bluntness.
Well, if I ever climbed in bed with you, I wouldn't take a cent. It would make me feel like one of those women who hang around the beach at the hotel. I'll never do that for money. I'm not that kind of a girl, and you better know it right from the start.
That's fine with me, Sol agreed. You'll be just a housekeeper. And you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. If it turns into something else, we'll talk about it when it happens. If it happens. But we need to start the Okeechobee now. You want to go and tell your daddy or what?
No way, she said,
still not sure to believe what was happening.
He'd beat the hell out of me. He's done it before, and I don't want any more of it.
He doesn't work Saturday afternoons, so he's home now. I can't even get my clothes. Don't worry about that, Sol said, getting up. I've got enough money with me to buy out a store. We'll stop and get whatever you need. As they walked back to the truck, Bonnie said,
I don't believe this. It's just not real. I thought I'd never get out of that cafe. You don't know how many times I thought about running away to Miami or Jacksonville, but didn't have the nerve to do it, and here you come out of nowhere, and suddenly I'm gone, just like that. I don't believe it's really happening to me.
It's real, Bonnie, Sol said. I wish I had found you a long time ago. The moment I saw you in the cafe, I knew I wanted to do this. I was afraid you'd turn me down. She stopped momentarily and said,
You know, Sol, you're a real nice fellow. I mean it. And good-looking is all get-out, too. I guess I'm about the luckiest girl in West Palm Beach. Plenty others would go with you, no questions asked. I'm sure glad you stopped at the cafe.
I am too, Bonnie. You're the kind of girl my mama would like. I'll take you to our homestead sometime. It's up on the Kissimmee River. You like it?
I already do, and you too. I'm not so sure how long I'll be able to stay on the payroll. I may not even make it for 1 week.
We'll see, Sol said, smiling. But we best get on the way. That truck stops after dark. The skeeters will suck us dry.
Then let's go,
she said enthusiastically, taking his hand in hers and pulling him hurriedly across the sand. Chapter 41 1918 The Ford touring car bounced along the road, leading past the east shore of the lake, swerving when it hit sand pockets. Sol said, If it wasn't for saving time, I'd rather be going up there on a horse. It's a lot smoother.
Does seem a bit rough,
Bonnie replied, almost shouting over the roar of the engine. But I'd never make it that far on a horse. I don't know how you stood it when you drove those cows clear across the state. Sometimes I don't either. I guess I was tougher then, and surely a lot younger. But I'd like to do it one more time just for the heck of it. I remember when it took us 3 days to move cows as far as we can go in 1 hour with this flivver, but we weren't in any hurry and didn't know the difference.
Are we going back by Punta Raza?
Yes, I want to check on the cabin and see if they got the fence done like I ordered. When you come to a nice shady hammock, we can stop and have a picnic. I've brought a real nice lunch. There's one just past Basinger, Sol said. We'll make it there right about noon. Bonnie's blue eyes sparkled as she said,
I just thought about something real nice, Sol.
What's that?
We could stop someplace where there's a preacher or a justice of the peace and then have a honeymoon in Punta Raza.
Ah, come on, Bonnie, he said, putting his hand on hers. You wouldn't want to do that.
Yes, I would. And one of these days I'm going to trap you into saying yes.
You probably will, but not quite yet.
That's what you've been saying for 7 years now. She sighed. Not quite yet. One of these days, Saul McIvey, I'm going to drag you to an altar. You'll see.
I might fool you and take you first. But preacher or not, Bonnie, you're here to stay. I wouldn't trade you for all the oranges and cows and vegetables in the whole world. And you know that.
Yes, I do know, she said tartly, flipping her blonde ponytail over her left shoulder. Saul insisted she wear her hair this way, like Glenda did. But it's just my cooking you're used to.
It's a heap more than that, Saul smiled, touching her hand again. But hush up now before you get me distracted and I ram this machine into a cabbage palm. We've got to get to the place by early afternoon. I've got a lot to do there before we go on to Punta Rasa.
That letter has really upset you, hasn't it?
Tim Lardy would never have written me twice to come back in a hurry unless something is bad wrong. I should have gone after the first letter, but I'm anxious to get there now and find out what it is that's got Tim in such a stew.
As Bonnie predicted that day they left Palm Beach together, their arrangement for her to be simply a housekeeper didn't last for even 1 week, and from that point forward their lives were comfortably entwined. She was a housekeeper, but she was also a companion and a lover and much more. She became Saul's business partner as well, doing all the clerical work and offering advice when Saul was in doubt about what he was doing. And her advice always proved right. But she never let up pestering him to visit a preacher or justice of the peace and make their life together legal. For several years after Saul left the homestead, he went back every few months to check things out. But as the vegetable business continued to grow and prosper and demand more and more of his time, the visits became less frequent. On one of his visits, he loaded the remaining money trunks on a Model T truck and took them to his house at Okeechobee, and this also made it seem less necessary for him to go back on a regular schedule. The war in Europe was a distraction, too, causing him to step up the production of his fields. He registered for the army, but was told his job supplying food was far more important to the war effort than being just one more soldier carrying a gun. So he took the work seriously, looking upon it as his substitute for wearing a uniform and possibly fighting for his country. It had been over 2 years since he was at the homestead, handling all business matters by mail. This had not bothered him, for the old place produced more and more cash income, and Clayton's books were always in order. But a year ago, Clayton wrote him that he was going into business for himself at Bartow and recommended that a man named Donovan replace him as manager. He assured Saul that Donovan was experienced with both citrus and cattle, so Saul took the recommendation and hired Donovan by mail. Saul had no reason to doubt his decision, for the income from the place continued to increase steadily. Then came the first letter from Tim Lardy, urging him to come back as soon as possible. He knew he should have gone at once, but he put it off for one thing and then another, and then a second letter arrived, this one even more urgent. At this point, Saul dropped everything, and he and Bonnie set out immediately, Saul regretful that he had not responded sooner. Saul turned from the main road and followed a trail leading across a section of prairie, the tall grass making swishing sounds as it brushed the underside of the vehicle. When it came to an area that should have been open pasture, but it was now an orange grove, it confused him, thinking perhaps he had taken the wrong turn. He stopped for a moment and said, "I know damned well this is where the corral was. We never planted trees here. Something is powerful strange, Bonnie."
"Are you sure we're at the right place?" she asked.
"I think so, unless I've gone crazy. Let's go under the house and see what this is all about."
He continued following the trail and became even more perplexed when he arrived at the spot where he thought the hammock would be, but found only more orange trees. He began to wonder if he really had come to the right place, but at the same time, doubting he could have forgotten so soon. Bonnie remained in the car as Saul started walking through the grove, searching for some sign of recognition. Startled once when a rabbit bounded from a clump of grass right at his feet and rushed away. And then he came to it, right in the middle of two rows of trees, 5 stones, all bearing the name McIvey. He stared for a moment, at once not believing, then realizing what had been done. He screamed furiously, "Damn you! Damn you, you son of a bitch! I'll kill you!"
The sound of it frightened Bonnie so badly she jumped from the car, trembling, as Sol rushed from the trees and slid beneath the steering wheel. She climbed back in quickly, her eyes terrified, as Sol cranked the car and spun it around, going full speed back down the trail, crashing into limbs and showering the air with twigs and leaves. He drove transfixed, his hands gripping the wheel. They skidded sideways when the trail split with another path leading off to the left. The Ford righted itself and roared forward again, the motor straining and leaving a trail of blue smoke that hung suspended just above the ground. Soon he came to a small clearing containing a house and two small cabins off to one side, all of them new and made of pine. The car skidded to a stop and spun around, facing back the way it had come. A cloud of dust boiled up as Sol jumped from the car and grabbed a Winchester from the back seat. Tim and Jesse then came from one cabin, and as soon as they recognized who it was, Jesse started crying. Tim ran forward and said, "I couldn't stop him, Mr. Sol. I tried, but he wouldn't listen to me." Donovan came around the side of the house, trotting, drawn by the sound of the unexpected commotion. He was a huge man, 6.5 feet tall, gruff-looking, built like an ox. Sol knew who he was without being told. He cocked the lever of the Winchester, pointed it, and said, "I'm going to blow your head off, you no-good bastard." Donovan froze. Looking at the trembling hand pressing the trigger, the barrel pointed directly at him, the rage in Sol's eyes. He spoke as calmly as possible. "You must be Mr. McIvey. How come you're in such a huff?" "What the hell do you mean by what you've done?" Sol demanded, hatred for this unknown man pouring from him like sweat. "I don't know what you mean." "You know," Sol shouted, his face now as red as his hair. "Them houses was rotting down," Donovan said, still looking at the rifle and not at Sol. "It wasn't worth a damn for nothing. And there's 300 acres of good land where that hammock was. Hell, I was hired to run a grove on a percentage basis, not look after some old shacks and run a old folks' home. You ought to be glad I cleared off all that stuff and put it in oranges. It'll mean more money for you." Bonnie had never seen Sol so angry, and she knew he was going to do it. She ran to him and pleaded, "Please, Sol, don't. What's done is done, and killing him won't bring it back. It'll only bring trouble. Please, listen to me." He looked at her terrified face, then back to Donovan, and then he said, "I want you off this place. In 10 minutes, you get in that goddamn truck over there and go. Whatever you leave behind will burn. Now move it and count yourself lucky. If you're still here in 10 minutes, so help me God, I'll kill you." Sol watched as Donovan went into the house briefly and then came outside dragging a frightened woman by the arm. He did not lower the rifle until the truck sputtered down the trail and disappeared. Tim then said, "I tried to stop him, Mr. Sol. He just wouldn't pay no mind to me at all." "What did he do with my granny's cook stove?" Sol asked. "He gave it to a junk man from St. Cloud. All the old tools and other stuff, too." "Damn." Sol then looked around and said, "Where's Lester?" "Over in his cabin. He don't work anymore, Mr. Sol. He's been too poorly. Mr. Donovan was going to run him off the place, and he would have, too, if you hadn't come right now." Sol tried to calm himself and think rationally, but the overwhelming anger wouldn't go away. He said, "I can't stay here any longer today, or I'll go after that bastard and kill him for sure. Tim, I want you to take over as manager and run the place from now on." Tim's eyes widened, and then he said, "Mr. Sol, I appreciate you saying that. I know the orange and cattle business as good as anybody, but I'm sure not a bookkeeper. I just couldn't handle that part of it at all." "It doesn't matter. I'll hire a bookkeeper in Kissimmee to come here once a month and take care of that. That's not important, but running the place is, and you can do it, Tim. The first thing I want you to do is rip out all those trees where the graves are, clear it all out. Then put an iron fence around it, and plant some oak back in there." "I'll do it, Mr. Saw. It near about killed me and Jesse when he'd done that. We knowed how you'd feel, but I just couldn't stop him." "We're going to go now," Sol said, his voice still trembling. "I'll go to Kissimmee and talk to a bookkeeper, and I'll also hire a couple of hands to come live here and work under you. I'll come back in about a month and help you set things up."
"I'll do a good job for you, Mr. Sol, and I'll see to the gravesite right away."
Without speaking further, Sol got into the car and drove off. When he reached the place where the corral had been, he stopped, leaned forward against the steering wheel, and cried bitterly. Bonnie put her arms around him but did not intrude, letting it all come out and be done with in his own way. He finally straightened up and controlled himself, and then he said, "You know, Bonnie, That bastard bulldozed 2 whole lifetimes. Everything Papa and Grampy did is gone now. It's a wonder he didn't pull out the stones and plant trees there, too. I should have stayed here and looked after the place. Those damned vegetable fields aren't worth this. It's all my fault.
That's not true, Saul, she insisted, feeling the pain with him. You couldn't have known this would happen. Don't feel this way, honey. Please don't.
A shocked realization came on Saul's face as something unexpected came into his mind. He suddenly understood why Toby had been so angry when he destroyed the custard apple forest, a place that both Zek and Toby loved. To them, it was much more than just another stretch of raw swamp and forest. And he had done the same thing Donovan had done. Only it was for vegetables, rather than oranges. He brushed his eyes and said, "They'll never forgive me for this, Bonnie. And I know I won't forgive myself. All they left behind is gone now, and regrets won't bring it back. Toby knew this. And now I do, too. Toby was right. And I was wrong. But it's done now, and what's done can't be undone. I guess nothing in this whole damn stinking world lasts forever." She did not know who Toby was, and none of it made sense to her. She passed it off as rambling grief, but the puzzled look stayed on her face as he cranked the car and drove off. When he reached a turn in the trail, he stopped and glanced back briefly, just to be sure the old corral was really gone. Chapter 42, 1924. After moving to Okeechobee, Saul made many trips into Miami. Occasionally at first, and then frequently as he established markets for his produce. On his first visit in 1908, the place did not even remotely resemble the sleepy little village he and Zek and Glenda rode into that summer day in 1895. As the trading post owner predicted when he sold them their parcels of land, the coming of Flagler's Railroad, which arrived the next year, did indeed change the face of the area. With each visit, Saul found something new, some seemingly overnight transformation. He made no plans whatsoever for the land they owned there, merely paying the taxes each year and letting the vegetation grow wild. Twice he purchased other small plots and threw the deeds into a box with the others. During one early visit, he did hire a skiff and cross the bay to see his beachside property, finding it exactly as the land agent described it, a mangrove swamp occupied by chattering birds and roaming animals, the beach itself a haven for sandpipers and gulls and terns and pelicans. In January of 1912, Saul and Bonnie went into Miami and purchased tickets on the first train to run from Miami to Key West over Flagler's Overseas Railroad, seeing the old man himself dressed in a black frock coat and silk stovepipe hat, the two of them staying in Key West for a 4-day celebration of the momentous event. The whole island was one big orgy of a party, such as neither of them had ever witnessed, not at Palm Beach or elsewhere. Rum flowed as abundantly as coconut milk, and there was wild dancing in the streets, picking up tempo at sunset and still going strong at daybreak. Outdoor tables overflowed with conch chowder and conch fritters, a dozen varieties of fish cooked in every conceivable way, piles of raw oysters and boiled shrimp, whole pigs roasted Cuban style with apples stuffed in their mouths, and baskets of fruit beyond count. They were both exhausted when they arrived back in Miami, and then returned gladly to the sedate life of their Okeechobee home. And then Saul began to see dredges in Biscayne Bay, pumping mountains of sand from the bay floor, building additional land on the strip that was becoming known as Miami Beach. And then it was connected by bridges to the mainland. His property soon became the only plot where birds and animals still prevailed over men and machines and building materials, and he continued to leave it that way. Unknown to him, developers searched frantically for this elusive family named McIvey that owned this prime beachfront acreage and also the extensive tract in Miami itself. On the original deed, Zek had listed the family address simply as Kissimmee Wilderness. After the war ended, the construction activity increased at a frantic pace, and then hordes of tourists in their newly acquired flivvers streamed into the area, wanting to see and own a piece of this tropical paradise, as advertised in northern newspapers and journals. A land of beauty beyond description, where the moon each night dripped honey onto silver beaches and swaying palms. Something strange was happening. Some electrifying surge that charged the air with excitement bordering the irrational. Saul sensed all of this as the tempo of land sales and construction increased, but he did not really know what to make of it. The frenzy then spread like an uncontrollable prairie fire, moving up the coast to Fort Lauderdale and Hollywood and Pompano and even into exclusive Palm Beach itself. More and more people, more and more developers, more and more real estate hucksters and swamp peddlers, more and more con artists of every type, the whole situation rapidly developing into a ludicrous circus. Saul and Bonnie watched from the sidelines and waited, frightened by all of it, Saul knowing that day by day and week by week his property became more valuable. Each rumor and each newspaper ad and circular listing land values stunned him, and he knew he would have to do something, either eventually or soon. But he continued to hold back, the potential value of his holdings staggering his imagination. In 1923, he made his first move, hiring a contractor to build a combination house and office in Miami, the first floor to be the business area and the second floor their living quarters. It was a small, inconspicuous place compared to the Spanish-style mansions rapidly dotting the area, the 10-story office buildings, and the vast hotels and apartment complexes. Saul built his house as if building a fort, with foot-thick concrete walls and iron grills across each window. One of the first-level rooms contained a walk-in vault, the same type as in a bank. The contractor thought Saul was either crazy or eccentric at best, warning him that such a monstrosity located inside a house would probably cost as much as the house itself. But Saul was adamant, insisting that it be done to his exact specifications, regardless of cost. His reason for this unusual addition was that he would keep his money himself, just as his father and grandfather had done, and trust no bank or anyone else with it. Had it not been for the McKivey system of banking by trunk, as started by Tobias and continued by Zek, there might not have been any McKivey land and no reserve money to purchase more or to develop what he now had. Saul figured what was good for them was good for him. Only his new trunk would be a great deal stronger than the steamers purchased by Tobias in Punta Raza. He soon owned the only house in Miami with a full-sized steel and concrete vault. And from the outside appearance of his place, no one else would know it was there. As soon as the house office was complete, Saul hired a foreman for the vegetable business and set forth with Bonnie to participate in the great Florida boom. The sign outside his office read, McKivey Real Estate and Development Company. After having it surveyed, Saul found that the 6,000 acres of mainland property covered a portion of the commercial area of the city and extended into one of the most sought-after residential areas, including waterfront. None of it was swamp or muckland, so there would be no need of drainage or filling before placing it on the market. He plotted only a small section at first, just to see what would happen, breaking an acre into individual lots of 70 feet by 100 feet in the commercial area. Then he studied current prices listed by other firms, finding that residential lots ranged from $20,000 to $70,000 according to location, and commercial property starting at $100,000 and going up from there. The Miami Beach acreage was even more valuable. He could not believe that people would actually pay so much money for such a small plot of raw land. That morning, he went to a small print shop and ordered circulars stating that McKivey Real Estate would be offering prime lots beginning at 8 a.m. the next morning, first come, first served. residential lots valued at $70,000 were reduced to $50,000 for cash only, and commercial lots for $100,000 cash only. No paper transactions accepted. He picked the circulars up at noon, and that entire afternoon he and Bonnie distributed them throughout Miami and Miami Beach, handing them out on streets and tacking them to light poles. All of Miami and Miami Beach was like a carnival, with people thronging everywhere. Car horns blared and were blended with the sounds of pounding hammers and machine gun riveters, all of Miami enveloped in clouds of dust. Real estate salesmen were in every door and on every street corner, dressed in the adopted uniform of white knickers and bow ties, offering free cigars and shouting like circus barkers as they held sheaves of deeds high in the air, enticing prospective buyers to examine their wares. Some pieces of property changed hands 5 and 6 times in one day, each purchaser selling it again for a higher price, most of it on option with a small down payment and mortgages. Paper empires were created rapidly on every corner. Tents were set up on vacant lots, with belly dancers and can-can girls and jugglers used to draw in the potential customers. After the entertainment a lecture was given concerning the certain riches of the land offered, then eager speculators lined up to plunk down their initial payments. They came from as far away as Europe, drawn magically to the land of eternal sunshine and flowers, buying lots sight unseen, some of it in swamps, reachable only by canoe. Saul vowed he would never do this, that all of his offerings would be of solid value and could be inspected in advance by any purchaser who wished to do so. Next, they crossed the bridge to Miami Beach and turned south, passing Spanish boom houses and towering hotels, coming into areas where sweating men in white knickers held forth at tables under trees, free champagne flowing, bands playing, every palm and palmetto laced with electric oriental lanterns that burned night and day, reams of freshly printed deeds stacked neatly on other tables, awaiting the signatures of buyers. All of it repulsed Saul. But he figured, if there were this many crazy people in the world, he might as well take advantage of it, too. He had no other use for the land except to sell it. To Bonnie, all of it was simply amusing, like visiting a zoo. And to both of them it was not something real, but a game being played in a fantasy world. Surely Saul thought this madness must end some day. The next morning they did not know what to expect, whether anyone would show up or not, especially since their lots were offered for cash only, while others gladly accepted paper. But when Saul opened the door, there was a line outside, people shoving and cursing as they waited impatiently in the sultry heat, afraid that all the bargain McIvy land would be gone before they reached the office. By noon, when he could not stand the shouting and mayhem any longer, Saul and Bonnie had sold and deeded 4 commercial lots and 9 residential lots for a take of $850,000 in cash. Saul told everyone outside to come back the next day, and then he put a closed sign on the door. Some still pounded and demanded to be let in. One man who purchased a commercial lot sold it to another man at the rear of the line for $200,000, half of it cash and half of it paper. The next morning was a repeat of the first, and by week's end, total sales amounted to more than $3 million, all of it stacked on shelves inside the vault. The frenzy went for months, with each day seeing more hotels and apartments and villas, more tract houses and private clubs and swimming pools, not reaching its peak until the middle of the next year. By this time, Saul and Bonnie were exhausted, and decided to spend several months resting at their Okeechobee home. They loaded a Pierce Arrow with suitcases and set forth for the peaceful country, leaving behind over $80 million in their Miami vault. Chapter 43, September 15th, 1928. Saul turned left at Belle Glade and headed for Lake Harbor and the Okeechobee House. It was Saturday, and they had driven up from Miami that morning, leaving the city because of advance warnings that a hurricane was approaching from the south. Memories were still too fresh of what had happened in Miami and Miami Beach 2 years before, when a September hurricane virtually destroyed the area, bringing an end to the great frenzied land boom. Sol and Bonnie had ridden that one out in their little concrete fortress, emerging unscathed into a devastated city littered with the trash of scattered houses, flattened hotels and apartment buildings, the harbor blocked by sunken vessels, 40-foot yachts resting forlornly on dry land a half mile inland. People had wandered the streets dazed, not believing that the great Florida sun god could do this to them, seeing all their hopes and dreams swept away by the shrieking winds and surging tides. The storm had turned paper millionaires into paupers overnight. Former tycoons now pushing wheelbarrows and working with crews on dump trucks, shoveling up litter and salvaging what little the wind spared. Sol and Bonnie were not hurt by it and were in fact helped. A week later they put a sign in front of their office saying, "We're buying." And they had the cash money to do so, paying 5 cents on the dollar for flattened property as people abandoned their deflated fantasies and headed back north, some sadly but gratefully accepting as little as train fare for what a year before had promised to make them into empire builders. Sol purchased property after property, believing that someday the area would recover. Undaunted personally when others gave up, because he knew of all those things nature unleashed against the McIveys during those decades of time when they suffered catastrophes worse than this and came back again and again, refusing to surrender. But they wanted no more of a Miami-style hurricane if it could be avoided, knowing they were lucky once but maybe not twice, and the sturdy old cypress house at Lake Okeechobee offered a safe haven out of the path of whatever was coming across the Gulf or Caribbean. They stopped at a country store and purchased supplies, making sure the house was well stocked with food for at least a week's stay, if that was necessary. After the suitcases and bags of groceries were deposited in the house, Sol set out alone to inspect some of his outlying fields. Although 2 years had passed since the savage 1926 storm, the area had not yet fully recovered from it, and some of the fields lay fallow. The storm spawned an aftermath of smaller disasters, and the following winter there were killing frosts, one after another, 7 in all, destroying crop after crop, even while seed still lay buried in the ground. Flooding from the lake had always been a problem, even though temporary, sometimes drowning crops and other times washing them away. But the effects of this storm lingered on for 6 months after the winds passed, bringing flood after flood until it seemed endless. And the destruction of the cities along the coast greatly reduced the local markets for vegetables and all other things, bringing depression to South Florida years before it was to strike the nation's heart elsewhere. But finally, it seemed to let up. And Sol now saw sprouts of winter crops creeping upward from the black soil, tiny plants that would soon grow to maturity and make the land bountiful again, providing vegetables to fill the bins of stores in the North and Midwest. When Sol returned to the house, he and Bonnie drove along a sandy trail leading to the lake, passing cabbage palm hammocks strangely devoid of birds. Huge oaks, whose limbs were normally playgrounds for barking squirrels, now empty and silent. As he rounded a bend, there was an area of open sawgrass off to the left, and the air above the marsh churned with white specks, so thick they formed a low-lying cloud. Sol stopped the car, and they both gazed at the strange phenomenon. Bonnie then said, "What is it, Sol? Is it insects?" "No, it's pollen," Sol replied. "It's not a good sign, either. Toby Cypress once told me that when sawgrass pollen boils like that, it means a great storm is coming. They flee from the sight of it. Maybe it's just another Indian legend, but it's weird, isn't it?"
"Yes, and I don't want to look anymore," Bonnie said, suddenly shivering. "It still looks like bugs to me, and I don't want to be around it."
Sol drove on, and then he parked on the bank of a drainage canal leading eastward from the lake. flights of herons and egrets and ibises were streaming above the water, moving northward. Not floating casually, as they often do, with wings outspread, but flapping constantly. The surface of the lake was deathly still, like a mirror tying together an immediate point with the horizon. In the distance, they could see commercial fishermen taking their boats toward the mouth of a creek, where they often sought refuge from storms. They both got out of the car and walked along the canal, watching small explosions as bass struck minnows lurking at the edges of pickerel weed. Then there was a more violent upheaval as an alligator snapped up one of the stalking bass, chomping it into a bloody pulp and then gliding away, its powerful tail weaving slowly, sending ripples against the bank. "That's the way it goes," Sol said, as the gator disappeared into a clump of weeds. "Minnow eats the skeeter eggs, bass eats the minnow, gator eats the bass. And next thing you know, he ends up as shoes and belts, his tail meat in somebody's frying pan."
"I feel sorry for the poor fish," Bonnie said distastefully. "I sure wouldn't want to be chomped up like that."
"Neither does the minnow, but nothing has a choice. Everything has to eat, Bonnie, including us. And we all eat each other. If we'd brought along our poles, we could have a fish fry tonight, the way those bass are striking."
"I've got steaks," Bonnie replied. "I don't want fish after watching that. And if you don't hush up that kind of talk, you won't get anything. You make me feel like a cannibal."
"I hope you don't think the cow those steaks came from committed suicide," Sol grinned. "But we won't go into that. I'll hush." They walked a short distance further, and then Sol said, "I've never seen the lake so still. And the birds all moving in one direction. I've got a gut feeling something is wrong here. Bad wrong."
"I do too," Bonnie said. "It's eerie. Maybe we should have stayed in Miami."
"One thing for sure," Sol said, slapping his arms. "The skeeters aren't leaving too. Let's get out of here before they have us for supper." As they drove back past the stretch of marsh, the pollen boiled even more, looking like millions of swarming gnats. Sol stopped briefly and looked again, saying, "If Toby were here, he'd be cutting out for somewhere else. Next thing you know, an owl will light on our roof and cry out. That's an even worse omen."
"Quit kidding me," Bonnie said, her voice serious. "This place is spooky enough without you scaring me worse with Indian tales. I don't want to hear any more of it."
The sun did not come up the next morning. Instead, it seeped through leaden skies that rapidly turned from gray to angry black, boiling like the pollen boiled. At first, the wind came in gusts, banging against the side of the house and causing palm trunks to bend double and then snap back. By mid-morning, it changed to a steady howl, bringing with it a sheet of pelting rain that came in horizontally, pinging sharply against the walls and window panes. Sol looked out one of the east windows and noticed that the door on the garage had come open. It flapped back and forth violently, as rapidly as blades on a windmill, shaking the structure on its foundation. When he opened the front door of the house to go out to the garage, the door slammed back with such force it knocked him sprawling across the floor, snapping one steel hinge like it was made of matchsticks. He and Bonnie put their shoulders against the door and forced it back, and then he nailed it shut. Bonnie backed away, exhausted, soaked instantly from rain that rushed through the open space and splattered against the living room walls. She said,
"I'm afraid, Sol. Really afraid. What are we going to do?"
"There's nothing we can do," Sol said, picking up the hammer and nails. "I'll nail every door and window shut, then pray the old house holds together. Looks like we jumped right out of it in Miami and landed in the path up here."
"I wish we'd stayed there," Bonnie moaned. "We could have got inside the vault and been safe."
The house cracked and vibrated constantly, as Sol put his arms around Bonnie and tried to reassure her. "Don't worry, honey. We'll make it through this. We always have, and we will again."
"I hope so," Bonnie replied. "But, Lord, I don't know, Sol. I just wish it would go away."
They ate cold beans for lunch, and shortly afterwards Saul looked out the window just as the banging garage disintegrated, pieces of walls and roof sailing upward and disappearing, exposing the Pierce Arrow to the full force of the wind. It bounced up and down like a rubber ball, skipping across the ground a few feet at a time, and then it rolled over and over and crashed into a clump of palm trunks. By mid-afternoon, the area outside the house was covered with brown foam as the lake water reached the yard. Waves on the lake gradually increased, starting at 2 feet and going to 6, crashing over the flat banks and rushing southward, and then it came like tidal waves, 10 feet high, wall after wall of wind-driven water, uprooting palms and oaks and anything in its way. It inched up the house's foundation, 3 feet off the ground, then it touched the porch floor and slushed in beneath the doors. Bonnie stared with horror as the water covered the floor 1 inch at first and then 3 inches, rising rapidly. She wailed, "Oh, my God, Saul, what can we do? A whole lake is coming down on us." "Stand on a chair," Saul shouted above the roar. "It can't come higher than that." But it did come higher, lapping the top of the dining room table. Then Saul put a chair on top of the table and climbed through an opening into the roof rafters, pulling Bonnie after him, the two of them clinging to studs as cypress shingles gave way and sailed off like leaves, exposing them to the pounding rain that made breathing almost impossible. And then it stopped suddenly, as instantly as if someone had flicked off a light switch. The night now deathly still, not a single drop of rain coming down. Saul looked up through a hole in the roof, seeing the moon and stars trapped inside a swirling mass shaped like an inverted ice cream cone, one big round area of peaceful sky surrounded by spinning madness. He said, "It's the eye, Bonnie. It's passing over us now. Are you still all right?" She pulled herself across the stud to him, sucking air into her tortured lungs. "I don't know, Saul," she gasped. "I can't hang on here much longer, and we're only halfway through it. Oh, God, honey, it's coming again, only this time worse. I don't know what we'll do."
"I'll hold you," Saul responded, putting his arms around her soggy body. "We'll make it, Bonnie. We have to. Just don't give up."
Water sloshed 2 feet below them as Bonnie said,
"Saul, I might as well say it now as ever. I love you, and I wouldn't trade our life together for anything. I'd do it all over again the same way if I had to, but we should have been married. I don't want to die in sin. My daddy wouldn't care, but my mother would. She would care, Saul, and I do too. Say you love me. If you'll tell me that now, it'll be all right."
Saul pulled her closer, feeling the fear tremble through her.
"I do love you, Bonnie, and always have. The first thing we'll do when this is over is look for a preacher, I swear it. And we should have done it a long time ago. Just because my mama and my granny died so sudden the way they did is no excuse for what I've done. It's a chance in life we all must take, and I know it now. No other McIvey before me ran from it, and I won't any longer. I love you, Bonnie, more than anything, and I declare you right now before God to be my wife, and tomorrow we'll have a preacher say the words."
She leaned over and kissed him. "Thanks, darling. That's what I wanted you to say. I can face it now. I think I'll be forgiven."
The first gust then struck the house, coming from the opposite direction of the previous wind, signaling the passing of the eye and the coming of the second phase. It increased rapidly, now roaring, rain coming again and pounding through the open roof, making further conversation impossible. Saul shuddered with anxiety and clung desperately to Bonnie as he felt the house being jolted from its foundation, moving off slowly, pushed along by surging water as the lake left its banks again and pounded southward. And then it exploded, sounding like a dynamite charge, sending boards and beams and window frames flying away with the howling wind. Saul felt himself ripped from Bonnie and flipped over and over like a coin, splashing down into angry, boiling water, gasping for breath as he went under and came back up again, grabbing frantically in utter darkness for something to hold to, finally locking his aching arms onto a section of roof as it swept by. His shouts of, "Bonnie! Bonnie!" were heard only by himself as he moved rapidly over what had once been a vegetable field. Dawn came from a sky still gray, but the violence was gone. Rain pelted down steadily as Saul opened his eyes and looked up. The roof section had come to rest against a drainage canal dike, and above him he could hear voices as a group of black field hands sang gospel hymns and prayed. The water was clogged with the remains of shattered houses and trees, and the floating bodies of dead animals and humans. A small child was jammed into the fork of a tree limb just to the left of Saul, its face frozen into a death mask of utter terror. He pushed away from the beams and pulled himself slowly up the muddy bank. At first unable to stand, kneeling and looking out across a brown sea. Not a tree was left standing, not a house or barn, nothing visible but water covering the earth as far as he could see. One of the field hands watched him for a moment, and then he said, "Bless you, brother, bless you. Praise the Lord for being spared." And then he returned to the hymn. Saul stared at the man blankly. Then he pushed himself up and staggered forward, seeing people further down the dike, his blistered eyes searching for some sign of a small woman wearing a blonde ponytail. He cried out, "Bonnie! Where are you? Bonnie!" Suddenly he stopped and shook his fists at gray clouds covering the sky, shouting, "Damn you! Damn you! You'll not do this again! We'll dike the lake so you can't do it again! Bonnie! Answer me, Bonnie!" But there was no answer, and never would be. Bonnie was among the 2,000 who died and had vanished forever. Chapter 44. Miami, 1954. Saul sat behind the massive mahogany desk in his office atop the McKivey State Bank, waiting impatiently for the woman to keep her appointment. He did not want to go through with this, thinking it foolish and an invasion of his privacy. The call came the day before from the executive director of the Greater Miami Economic Council, telling him he had been selected Citizen of the Year for his lifetime contributions to the Miami area and to Florida. But so little was known about his private life, which he guarded zealously, they had requested an interview to gain information for publicity and for the award ceremony to be held the next week. Finally, she was ushered in. A young woman of 22, with deep green eyes and black hair, wearing shoes with spikes 4 inches tall. She was visibly nervous as she took a seat in front of the desk. She took a notepad and pen from her purse and said, "I'm Alice Bryant, Mr. McKivey. I've always wanted to meet you, but never thought I would. And I want to congratulate you on the honor. You certainly deserve it for all you've done for the state."
"Just what is it you want to know?"
Saul asked, bored already as he leaned back in the chair.
"Oh, just everything," she replied enthusiastically. "Something about your family background, how you got your start, where you went to school, all that sort of thing."
Saul's eyes suddenly twinkled with mirth as he said,
"Okay, Miss Bryant, I'll talk and you take notes. Then you can ask questions. First, my granddaddy was a plantation owner in Georgia and came to Florida before the Civil War to establish a cattle and citrus empire. He served as a Confederate general during the war. My papa helped Grampy buy the land and start the business, and I learned it from them. But before I took it over and expanded it, I was sent away to college, graduated from the University of Virginia in 1906, magna cum laude. My mother was from a pioneer family, too, and so was my wife. She died back in 1928. My wife's father was one of the founders of Palm Beach. Now, the way we really started the McKivey Empire was..."
The Okeechobee Hurricane of 1928 changed the face of the land forever. As Saul vowed that morning as he searched vainly for Bonnie, the lake was eventually diked,
surrounded by such a high mound of dirt that its waters would never again be seen from ground level. Then drainage canals were cut, drying up the muck soil until summer winds blew it away, turning the life-giving water away from the big cypress swamp and the Everglades, creating drought in dry seasons when the natural flow from the lake no longer came, and flooding in rainy seasons because the earth could no longer absorb it. It was all done with good intent and faith at the time, but nevertheless created a travesty against nature that could never be reversed. Saul played a big part in it because of his anger at the storm and Bonnie's death. He rebuilt the Okeechobee house, this time of concrete and steel, and then he went back to Miami. When the Depression came in 1929, causing banks to fail, he started his own, naming it the McIvey State Bank and stocking it with hard cash from his private vault. His McIvey Developing Company continued buying land during the 1930s, moving up the coast and inward, draining vast areas and then waiting for the Depression to pass before developing them. He built a mansion on Key Biscayne, not because he wanted it, but because he thought it to be something Bonnie would have enjoyed. He lived there alone, with only his household servants, giving no thought to marriage or living with a woman again. When World War II came, he did his part by serving as chairman of war bond drives and donating money to the USO. Later on, he gave generously to numerous charities and civic projects, but never attended social functions, the name McIvey becoming associated with some elusive philanthropist hiding from public view. After the war, it started again, another boom, not as frenzied as the madness of the 1920s, but boom nevertheless. McIvey Development surged forward, dredging and filling, building tract houses with their St. Augustine lawns and transplanted cabbage palms, blocking off the ocean beaches with towering condominiums and gigantic apartment complexes, moving westward into the Everglades from Hollywood and Fort Lauderdale and Pompano and Boca Raton and Lake Worth. Saul was no longer an active part of it, turning the management of the company over to eager young executives he hired. But before he realized what was happening, he had created a juggernaut that would not stop until the last swamp was drained, the last tree felled, and the last raccoon left to scrounge scraps from garbage cans or starve. In 1952, he built his hotel, naming it the La Florida, 25 stories of concrete and glass overlooking the ocean on Miami Beach. Again, he did it not because he wanted another business enterprise, but because he remembered the vow he had made that day in Palm Beach so many years ago. When the hotel held its grand opening, he did not attend the gala celebration, which featured a bevy of Hollywood stars. More and more, he retreated into his private Key Biscayne world, serving as boss of the McIvey Empire in name only, knowing now what was happening, but closing his eyes to it, looking the other way. He also withdrew more and more into the past, living in the world of Tobias and Zeck, letting his imagination and his memories take him backward in time. The name McIvey became a phantom, not something real, but meaningless letters across bank buildings, art centers, and small parks. Saul sat at the head table, looking out at a sea of faces he did not know and did not want to know. Pounds of diamonds caught the light from glittering chandeliers and magnified it, and women were draped with furs despite the outside heat. Saul's red hair was now sandy gray, but his lean body was still as ramrod straight as it had ever been. He was dressed in a black suit, custom made by a tailor just for this occasion, patterned after those worn by men prior to the turn of the century. He also had on a string tie and looked like a relic taken from a just-opened 1880 time capsule. This was the way he wanted it, and he drew curious glances from everyone in the room, almost all of them seeing him for the first time. Finally, the evening neared the climax as a man droned on and on at the microphone. Saul did not listen to the introductory speech, knowing already what would be said about him. But the closing words came through to him. "One of Florida's most prestigious families, a man who played a major role in conquering the wilderness and bringing civilization and progress to Florida." He got up to thunderous applause and made his way to the podium. He adjusted the mic upward, then he spoke slowly and deliberately. "All that stuff you just heard about me is pure bullshit. It's all lies I made up just to see how gullible you are. And it's all a shame on the name of McIvey. To all those McIveys who left this earth before me, I apologize for telling such whoppers." He paused for a moment, looking out over an audience now shocked into silence, and then he continued. "My granddaddy wasn't any plantation owner in Georgia. He left there dirt poor and starving. And when he arrived here, all he owned was in an ox cart. He didn't start a cattle and citrus empire. He and my granny and my papa slept on the ground and ate coons and rabbits till he could build a shack to live in. He caught wild cows in the swamps till he had enough to sell the first bunch, and then he went from there. I'd never been to college one day in my life, much less hold a degree from anywhere. My grampy and granny were illiterate, and my papa was too till he married my mama, and she taught him to read and write. Everything I know she taught me at night beside a coal oil lamp. My grampy would never buy the land and never owned so much as a grain of sand. He was a squatter. He believed that no man can own the land, that it all belongs to the Lord, and the Lord lets us stay on it temporarily as tenants. If this is so, and I now believe it's so, then the Lord must be powerful mad at all of us for what we've done to his property. There'll be a day of reckoning for you and for me. The first land owned by my papa was won in a horse race in Punta Rasa, and the first land I bought on Miami Beach was bought with money I earned selling buzzards on the street of Palm Beach. It wasn't me who, as was said, conquered the wilderness. I am the least of the McIveys. It was Tobias McIvey and Emma and Skillet and Zek and Glenda and Frog and Bonzo and several others I won't even mention. All I did was cash in on what they did. They're buried right now in the middle of an orange grove beside the Kissimmee River. And that's where I'll rest, too, when the time comes. And it might also interest you to know that my papa hung enough men to fill this head table. I killed, too, when I had to. The ones who got the shaft from all this so-called progress were an old man named Keith Tiger and Tawanda Cypress McIvey, and my half-brother Toby Cypress McIvey, and a bunch more still living out yonder in the swamps in Chickies. When I first started out alone after my papa died, I didn't know what I was doing. And I thought I was doing the right thing, but you sons of bitches knew, and you did it deliberate. That's the only thing that marks me from you. The catch word with me is stupidity. With you, it's greed. More is better. Bigger is better. Well, you bastards are too stupid to know there soon won't be no more. Else you haven't been here long enough to remember. All of you who don't like what I've said here tonight can kiss my ass. I don't give a damn about you, and you don't give a damn about me, pure and simple. And besides that, you've seen the last of me you'll ever see. I'm going to hide from such as you and pray for forgiveness for what I've helped do. If I could rip out the concrete and put back the woods, I would. But I can't. Progress ain't reversible. What's done is done forever, and I'm sure as hell not proud of it. If any of you idiots had the brains of a jaybird, you'd stop right now, too. From what we've done to this place in just the past 50 years, what the hell you think it's going to be like in another 50? He stopped abruptly, stepped back, and said, "I do thank you kindly for your attention." Then he walked briskly to the nearest exit and left. Chapter 45. Punta Rasa.
1968. Morning sunlight streamed through the east window, as Saul sat in a cane-bottom rocker, staring at an old board tacked to the wall. Its white letters were badly faded, but still readable. McIvey Cattle Company. Sunbeams seemed to catch in the ancient paint and make it glitter. The glow hurt his eyes, so he got up and closed the curtains. Just beside the window, there was a gun rack containing several Winchesters and a 10-gauge double-barreled shotgun. He picked up the shotgun and aimed it, its tremendous weight pulling his frail arms downward. He cocked one hammer and squeezed the trigger, hearing a sharp click as the firing pin popped into an empty chamber. Then he put it back into the rack beside a rusty branding iron. He crossed the room and took one of the two whips from a dresser drawer. Then he went outside and popped it. The awesome sound sent a frightened rabbit bounding away. He cracked it again and again, seeing phantom cows scatter in front of him. And then he felt a hot pain sear through his chest. There was a cypress bench beside the cabin porch, and he staggered to it and sat down. Sweat poured from his face as he watched himself race across the clearing on Tiger and jump the split-rail fence, going after Zek as he rode south, seeking the outlaws. He heard his mother shout, "Saul McIvey, you come back here this instant." For a moment he thought of going inside and searching for the pill bottle, but Bonnie came and sat beside him, distracting him. She took his hand in hers and said, "Thanks, darling. I can face it now." Then, suddenly, they were all out there looking at him, McIvey's all, burned brown by prairie sun and wind, living and loving and dying, one by one, bidding him farewell as they faded back into the harsh glow of sunlight, leaving him desperately alone again. The pain increased as his tired eyes squinted and looked after them, seeing them come and go now, Zek galloping wildly on a marsh tacky, Skillet throwing a bull with just a twist of his powerful body, Frog stuffing himself with stew as Emma put more bowls on the table, Glenda in her jeans and boots, Bonnie's ponytail flapping as the wind rushed through the open Model T. As his eyes glazed, the last one to appear was Tobias, looking like a living scarecrow in his faded overalls and wide-brimmed hat, leading all of them, heading westward as they searched for a Babylon called Punta Rasa. He gazed to the west, where the shipping port had once been, straining to hear the bellowing of penned cows, hearing instead the roar of gasoline engines somewhere to the north. He said weakly, "Where did it all go? Papa, where?" The whip dropped from his hand, just as a dove called mournfully for a missing mate, no longer able to answer. It lay, crumpled, beside the nearby highway, hit and crushed lifeless by a speeding automobile.
The End. You've been listening to A Land Remembered by Patrick D. Smith, narrated by George Guidel. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Orchard by Larry Watson, also narrated by George Guidel, and Montana 1948 by Larry Watson, narrated by Beau Bridges. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.